A scathing report by Kentucky State Auditor Allison Ball found that Kentucky's foster care system is in crisis. Within a two-year period between January of 2023 and October of 2024, the report found that 304 children spent time in unlicensed settings, including state offices, hotels, and state parks. Now, many of these children needed psychiatric care. Some were considered flight risks. 81% lacked medical care, and many of them failed to be in school. So how does something like this happen in the Commonwealth of Kentucky? And what, if any, are the consequences? Joining us to talk further is Kentucky State Auditor Allison Ball. Allison, thank you for your time and welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So your report was made public a week ago today.
Yes, that's right.
As we're recording. Yep. But I want to start with this. We've known about this issue for 4 years.
Yeah, we have.
So 4 years, we've known that the CHFS, Cabinet for Health and Family Services, has been placing children in state offices or state parks. How could this have gone on for so long?
So that's a great question. So you're right. We first began to hear about this in 2022. That's when the news started reporting. And at that point in time, it was just Louisville media that was picking it up. And they were talking about the LNN building, which is, you know, an old high-rise building downtown. At that point, the reporters were investigating it, and they found out the kids didn't have showers. At that point, they were literally sleeping on cots in the office building. And that led to a judge allowing reporters into the courtroom because there was a child who was sleeping there. And at that point in time, the social workers were not obeying the judge's orders. Mm. That child was not supposed to be in contact with other children, and the child was put with other children, I believe, in that office building. So that was the first break of this information coming out there, 2022. And we know that this has been happening at least since then. And I heard about it. I was state treasurer then, so I heard about that during that period of time. Before I was state treasurer, I was a prosecutor, and I dealt with dependency, neglect, and abuse cases. So I dealt a lot with foster kids. I've really had a heart for them ever since that experience and the kind of situations that they go through. They're just really challenging on young kids. So I heard about that, was horrified like other Kentuckians. And then when I became state auditor, something happened in my office that gave us the opportunity to really look into this particular issue. And that was the ombudsman's office. I became a part of the auditor's office. And the ombudsman is dedicated to investigating and making recommendations for the Cabinet for Health and Family Services. And of course, that's the cabinet that deals with foster kids. Mm-hmm. So originally, and you're asking like, how did this happen? Originally, CHFS was saying, this is an emergency situation. We just don't have rooms. Yeah. They were originally saying it's limited to teenage boys mostly. And they would describe them as high acuity, meaning they have a variety of issues that we just can't get them placed anywhere. You know, foster care parents don't want them. We can't find treatment for them. We just got to put them somewhere. And so at that point, they're like, it's an emergency. The cabinet secretary at the time was saying, we will spend whatever it takes to resolve this problem. It's just temporary. So when the ombudsman's part of the office became a part of the auditor's office, I had remembered these stories. And I had remembered the cabinet saying, this is temporary. It's limited to mostly violent high school boys. Right. And so we wanted to look at and see, okay, is this resolved? Has it been taken care of? And they did that part of my office did a preliminary investigation a little over a year ago, did a real quick 4-month review just to find out, is it still ongoing and what kind of child is having this happen? So during that time period, they did 4 months, found out that there were 49 kids in that review period. In that 4-month period of time, there were kids as young as 1, 2, and 3. So those cannot be categorized right. as high acuity kids. There were a lot of older kids that were, but the average age of that period of time was 13. Mm. So you have just as many young kids as you have older kids. So the picture was not entirely accurate. And we also thought at that point in time that it was just Louisville. We thought, okay, it's an urban problem. So we did that preliminary investigation. We found out that it was all over the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And that then led to the decision of we need to do a full-scale, deep-dive investigation throughout the Commonwealth of Kentucky, find out why this is happening. What are the conditions? Are there policies in place? So that led to the investigation, which it took us a year to do. And actually, we wanted it to be faster than that, but we had a lot of trouble getting information from the Cabinet for Health and Family Services.
So let me stop right there and interject. Yes. So you are an elected state official. The Auditor of Public Accounts is essentially the watchdog for the taxpayers. You're making sure that various state agencies, whether local level, state level, what have you, that their books are correct, right?
Yes.
That money is being spent where it should be. But then you also, in this case, you're looking at a process, a procedure that was not in line with state expectations.
That's a great way to sum it up, yes.
So you're telling me that the CHFS, I would guess you went to the secretary, cabinet secretary, and requested the information And what did they tell you?
Yeah. So when we first opened the investigation, we actually had some encouraging conversations with Secretary Friedlander at that point in time. And he was the one who was like, we'll spend anything. We'll do whatever it takes. We want to resolve this problem. So we were really hopeful. And my comments, my public comments were that I want to collaborate. I just want to solve the problem. And it works better. We are an investigative body and we make recommendations. And our investigation is better if we can do it collaboratively. Our recommendations are better if we can work on it together. Mm-hmm. So I really have seen this the whole time as something that I've wanted to pursue collaboratively. It's not like trying to get you in trouble and wag your finger at somebody. It really is. It's a problem and we want to resolve that problem. So originally, I was hopeful that we would be able to do this in coordination with each other. But over time, it became clear that they really did not want to cooperate with us. They wouldn't answer our questions, slow walk things. And then by the end, by October of last year, once they had a new secretary, we said, we would love to meet with you. And we kept sending over open invitations to meet with leadership so we could have a plan for our investigation so we can make sure we're all on the same page. But the new secretary, Secretary Stack, sent a letter that essentially said it would be fruitless to work with you all. The letter said that we don't have the expertise to do this kind of investigation. All of our comments were things that were available to the public anyway. We don't know what we're doing, which is funny because almost our entire staff in the ombudsman's office was trained by CHFS. So they were CHFS employees not long ago, and they were transferred over to my office. So if they're not experts, then CHFS is the reason why they're not experts. And they are experts. This is what they do. They investigate and they make recommendations. So I think it's frustrating to me on a personal level because I see this as a real problem and I just want it resolved.
Let's put a finer point on some of the findings in your 129-page audit.
Yes. I got it right here. It's a big audit.
Big audit.
It's actually not an audit. And I try to be clear on it. It's not an audit because it came from the ombudsman side. It's a report. Okay. So the ombudsman is tasked with the responsibility of doing investigations and then making recommendations. So technically speaking, it follows different rules from an audit. That sounds very
report.
Technical.
We'll call it. Thanks for that correction.
Yeah.
So a couple of the high points here of some of the egregious findings in this report. One child fled her placement and was located 51 days later, living in a tent with a middle-aged man wanted for murder. One child was physically assaulted by a provider. One child reported that she was the victim of sex trafficking that occurred after she fled her placement. Another child, in contradiction to her faith, was given a Ouija board to play with by a social worker. As we mentioned, many of the children were housed in facilities, state offices, state parks, many without showers or other necessary living accommodations. Some buildings were not zoned for residential use, and it was not readily apparent that local fire departments were notified that people were residing in the office buildings. The list goes on and on. There were several other high points, but these are incidents. I don't recall seeing these in the news or reading about these incidents. Doesn't mean they didn't happen, but this was a revelation in this report to see just how egregious some of this was. I think 81% of the cases, there was not proper medical care, medication management, or even verification that kids were attending schools.
Right.
And this was 304. We're talking 304, as I mentioned earlier, children who were spending time in unlicensed areas. And that's a sanitized way of saying that they were sleeping in office building or in other places that were not meant for children to stay in.
Yeah. And the other places were mostly hotels, state parks. And when I say state parks, it's usually the state park hotel, like a cabin or a lodge or something like that. Sometimes community centers, emergency shelters, hospitals, not because they were sick, but because they just had to be put somewhere for a period of time. So the Cabinet for Health and Family Services has referred to them as non-traditional placements, which I think is a very sanitized name for office buildings and hotels, state parks, et cetera. But when we looked at the office buildings themselves, we found the ones that we did site visits, none of them had showers. So these kids have to be driven over to a fire department, to the YMCA, somewhere else. And it's interesting because CHFS does reviews of treatment centers when kids are staying there. And they would be disqualified if they didn't have a place for kids to shower. So they're not even really following their own rules that they impose on other people for themselves. But I'm glad that you listed some of we had some profiles in here because we really wanted to show this is the human impact of kids going through this kind of experience. We didn't have good documentation about medical care. We didn't have good documentation about attending school, all those things. And we had those actual stories of things that have happened to kids. And they're nightmarish, horrible stories of things that happened to kids. There was some of them are kids that have diagnoses that require very specific oversight and very specific treatment. Some of them are young kids that don't have diagnoses at all. Like they've just been removed from home and they're very young. We had 17 kids that were six and under. And of those, four of them were infants under the age of one. So you have some really, really young kids. And through this, we found out there's really two populations we're looking at. We have a population of about 130 that they don't have diagnoses that require very specific treatment and very specific oversight. And then you had the rest of the kids, 170-some, who did require a lot. Like some of these kids were suicidal. Some of these kids set fire to things. Some of them are very sexually aggressive because of things that have happened to them. And they should be treated differently than these young kids that don't have issues. So we found that there were no formal policies in place governing how they should be treated, you know, whether you fall into this category or the next category. Just really a breakdown on all levels.
Hi, this is Mike Harmon, State Outreach Director for the Commonwealth Policy Center. Some of you may remember me as Kentucky's former state auditor or as a former state representative, but I want to speak with you today about the great work of the Commonwealth Policy Center. We look to find, educate, and elevate leaders who have a biblical worldview. And if that's something that you value as well, then I would ask that you become a CPC Insider. For just $25 a month, we will send you our quarterly printed newsletter, our monthly email newsletter, our Insider Live with CPC, and you will receive invitations to special events we hold throughout the year. If that's something that you can help with, please go to CommonwealthPolicyCenter.org, hit the Donate tab, and sign up for a $25 a month reoccurring donation. Thank you, and God bless.
What do other states do when they have a difficult time placing children in the foster care system? I mean, have you looked? What is the standard? What are other states doing?
That's a great question. We did look at other states because we understand that this has happened in other states, too. Tennessee had this exact same problem, and they've been doing a lot of work to resolve it, and they've made massive progress. So they have really engaged the faith-based community. And that's one of the things that we said. And I think we're starting to see more of that from CHFS since this report came out. I've heard more. I think they're doing a summit this week to try and get more foster parents. And that's great. It's exactly what we want. We want more engagement with the faith-based community. We found a church in Bowling Green that donated a house, and it has a bathroom and a kitchen and three bedrooms. And that particular area doesn't use office buildings anymore because they have this house available to them. And the social workers go and they stay there with the kids, same as they would at an office building, but they're actually at a house. And we heard from one young child, it was reported to us that he said when he stayed there, it was the nicest place he'd ever stayed in his life. So there are ways I think the faith-based community can be hugely impactful in addressing this. There needs to be more recruitment of foster parents. There does need to be more treatment facilities available. Faith-based community can be a huge key to resolving this. Tennessee has done that. Tennessee has also made a high trauma location for kids that are just really difficult, and they have serious issues they've got to deal with. And that is the reality, unfortunately, that some kids do have extra need for care. And so that's part of it. So I think an investment is a part of it, and getting more treatment facilities available, all those things.
At least having some kind of a backup. And again, I'm looking at this from the outside. I've not dug into it like you have, but there has to be some kind of a contingency, some kind of a plan that's better than what CHFS has been doing. Children should not sleep on office floors. They shouldn't be in places that don't have bathrooms or showers. And it sounds like not only have they not had that contingency or looked ahead, but they've not followed through with the expectations as this was revealed 4 years ago.
Right. And they have made some improvement. The kids aren't sleeping on the floor anymore. They were in the beginning. They were just having to sleep on cots. We did see reports of kids sleeping on couches and air mattresses, but they have started to put like beds in the office buildings, which I suppose is better. But at the end of the day, they still are sleeping in an office building. Right. And, you know, actually, let me read this to you because this is something that really bothered me when we saw this. Some locations, some office buildings, they will hand out this letter and it says, "Hello, unfortunately, we have been unable to secure a placement for you. We are continuing to look for a placement for you. Until we locate one, you will be spending time with DCBS. This is a tough situation for everyone." And the idea of a 14-year-old kid who's been through trauma, who's being put in an office building, is basically told nobody wants you, just sounds like that's going to exacerbate whatever problems they already have. So just a wide variety of breakdowns across the board in this situation. You mentioned medical care. A lot of these kids have prescriptions. Vast majority of these kids have prescriptions for a variety of issues. And we found very shoddy documentation. There were two kids in particular that we did find that there was consistent documentation, but it had breakdowns even in that. And when we looked at what was being documented, we found the wrong dosage being given, missed doses, and then double doses. So again, there's a serious oversight problem. Being a runaway is a huge risk. We looked at the ages 12 to 17. About 40% of those kids were at risk for being a runaway, either because they'd done it before or they said they were going to do it. So they told you, I want to run away. And these buildings, a lot of times they're in strip centers, they're in a high rise, they're by an interstate. Some of them are by a body of water. And it's really easy for these kids to escape. Many of these have public access to these buildings. Easy in and out of the doors. One site visit we went to, the room the kids were sleeping in had a door that went outside. And you do have a high number of these kids that do, in fact, actually run away. And when they do run away, then you end up with a girl who's in a tent with a man wanted for murder.
What's the liability, if you can speak to this, I'm not sure if you can, of when there is a child, a minor in state custody, and they leave. And in this case, there was a minor that was gone for almost 2 months with a murderer. What if something bad, and I'd say all very much bad, has already happened to these children? What happens if a child dies or if a child just disappears? Can the state be sued? What is the responsibility of the state if the parents come back and say, hey, you took my child was in your care, and they're harmed?
Yeah.
Because what happens?
It would be difficult just because it's a state actor, and sovereign immunity comes into play, and there's issues involving that. So they could for certain egregious situations.
How about for social workers that are neglecting their duty? I mean,
even
a social worker that gave the Ouija board to a child against their faith. I mean, that's, I don't know where that's considered a good practice, but maybe that's not the best example, but what kind of responsibility do social workers have?
And that's a great question. So because it is the state that's operating this way, it is difficult to sue. It can be done. It's difficult. But that's why my office is critical here. My office is supposed to be the accountability, the exposure, the corrective body here to resolve this. We also made recommendations, too, for greater accountability. All of these children have court-appointed guardian ad litems. And we found about 50% of the time the GAL is not notified that your child's been put. The child's been put in an office building or a state park or whatever it is. And if you had their court-appointed attorney aware of what's going on, then there would be more accountability there. So we think there are ways. We actually also made a recommendation in certain instances where the parents should also be notified that your child is, you know, in a non-traditional placement, something like that. So the more accountability measures that are put into place, I think the better that this will be. Washington State requires an annual report to their state legislature. They also had this problem. They've done a lot of work to resolve it. Incidentally, a blue state, and they have done a lot of work to resolve this. And one thing that they have done is they require their equivalent of the Cabinet for Health and Family Services to give an annual update. This is how many kids that had to sleep in a non-traditional placement last year. This is what we're doing to resolve it. This is our plan moving forward. And that increases accountability. So we actually made that recommendation too. If the cabinet was forced to check in from time to time, you wouldn't have to do these massive investigations, checking to find out what's really going on.
Allison, when your report dropped, I think it was within 24 hours that Governor Beshear objected. I believe he held a press conference, and he said that he objected to your report overall and said that he should have received the report before it was released. Is that true?
So he's thinking about audits. Audits, they do get a 15-day early report. This was different. This was a ombudsman investigation. This is the kind that's supposed to be, once it's completed, it is available, and they have 15 days to respond. And we've been pretty clear on that. In fact, even in our press release, we said they have 15 days to respond. We think this report is serious, so we are eager for their responses. We want their responses. I want to know what the governor's office says. But they've never been cooperative with us. They basically told us, go away, in that letter in October. We have tried to communicate with them the whole time. We have wanted them to be a part of this process, and they have not wanted to be part of the process.
So standard practice when you release an audit to give that agency that's being audited 15 days, 2 weeks?
Yeah, for an audit, you do a draft to them. But for an investigative report, it's a different set of circumstances. It's supposed to be for CHFS, and it has more of a public aspect to it. So that one is a 15 days after release. The audits are 15 days before release. Okay. Yeah, different rules. And it's by statute.
This is what Governor Andy Beshear said in his press conference, is that, quote, my concern is that those reports also violate core auditing principles. When you conduct an audit, you have to give the agency that you're auditing a chance to comment on it because you might not have it all right. That was not done here. Then he goes on to say that there were errors. In fact, it was released to the press before it was even placed online, and certainly no chance for us to review. And it contains errors that if we'd had a chance, would have been able to fix?
I think he's been careful to say likelihood of errors. But again, it wasn't an audit. The audit statute does require 15 days prior release to the public. Mm-hmm. You send it to them. Ombudsman investigative reports don't have that requirement. In fact, their system is just different. It's just, it's a completed report. It's then available to the public. Then they have 15 days to respond. So I don't know if he knows the difference between an audit and a report. He may not. Staff may tell him. I don't know. But yeah, that's kind of been, this is not my first go around with work that we've done when he says like, hey, I don't like it. And this is what's happened here. Yeah.
So did your report contain errors? Are you aware?
No, I do not. I do not know. And actually what we said back to him too, because we issued a statement as well. We relied on the governor's data for this. And it took us a while to do it because we had to dig through without their assistance. And I would have loved to have had their assistance. It would have been a much smoother, quicker process if we'd had that help. We didn't. So it took us a while, but we relied on all their own data. And if there's something wrong in it, then there's a deeper problem here because that means the governor's data is wrong.
Allison, how would you address the charge that this is a politically motivated report? And I'm not saying anybody has, but how do you address that? I see sure, that well, probably people are thinking.
Well, the governor has said that. He's said that every time I've issued anything in the last 2 years I've been in office. That's his knee-jerk reaction is that it's political. And I've learned that's a very common response to people whenever people don't like to be audited. Yeah. They don't like to have investigations. They don't like to have reports. So it takes a lot to be able to step back for a moment and say, okay, is there a real problem? Do I need to work on something? And I think, unfortunately, that's his knee-jerk reaction is that it's political. I've been doing this for a while. I've kind of come to learn that's often people's response. They don't like to be engaged in it. But my answer to that, and this is my encouragement to him, step back for a moment. Step back for a moment. Look at the situation that we're talking about here. This is a serious situation. It's not a political situation. It's not a game. These are real children. These are real instances. And it's been reported by the media for 4 years now. I would like to see from him a more responsive, okay, this is a serious problem. I would like to collaborate and resolve this problem. That's my posture. I would like to collaborate. I live and hope that we can continue to do that. We can do that at some point for the future. So my hands are open to the governor. I would love to work with him to resolve this. I would love to assist in resolving this problem. So that's my answer.
The governor, thank you. According to the governor, and again, I don't want to belabor this, but I would welcome somebody from the governor's staff or the Secretary of Cabinet for Health and Family Services to come on and join us and to share their perspective. They're welcome to come on the Commonwealth sure. Matters. One more point that the governor said, well, maybe a couple more. He said that non-traditional placements that this report refers to are rare in Kentucky, counting for roughly 1-2% of cases. Your response, they're relatively rare.
So we went through and we used the governor's own numbers. Like it's 300 kids in a 20-month, a little over 300 in a 22-month period of time. That is a smaller percentage. I agree. It's a smaller percentage of the total. But the fact that you have even one child that this is happening to is, in my mind, one child too much. And I'm concerned that's overly dismissive of the problem to be like, it's a small percent. And he does hone in on most of the kids, he would say, and he has said, are these violent kids that are difficult to place.
Yeah.
A lot of those kids are, but they aren't all that. Even if that's the case, though, even if that's the case, that's one too many. In fact, those high acuity kids, those kids that are violent, those kids that need special care because they're suicidal or they are aggressive, we should be doing more, not less, to address those kids. Yeah. So that concerns me that is the reaction that this warrants from him. I think the reaction should be, if there's one kid, that's one kid too many. And again, I want to collaborate. I want to resolve the problem. That's what I care about, resolving the problem. I'm not here to point fingers. I just want to solve the problem.
Yeah, very good. If I could, in the remaining couple of minutes that we have here, I want to look at the Kinship Caregiver Program. This was passed by the legislature a few years ago, and it would allow close family relatives to care for a child placed in foster care, family relatives or friends, grandparents or aunts and uncles that were close to the children, or maybe neighbors that were almost like family.
Yes.
And even though it was passed, the governor has failed to execute on this law. His argument, as I understand it, is that he doesn't have the resources to do that. Now, you were in front of the Kentucky Court of Appeals last month. Asking for the numbers, if I understand, how much would it take? What are the reasons why? Is that correct?
Yeah,
tell us more about that.
That's a good summary. So we talked about that in this report as well. We said that kinship care is actually a good way to resolve this problem too. So as you just said, kinship care, it's grandmas, it's aunts and uncles, it could be godparents. Sometimes it's a teacher. It's somebody who's treated like a relative because they're so close to the family. And right now, under the law that was passed 2 years ago, they can have the same resources available to them that foster parents have, which is great because a a lot of these relatives that step up. They come from low income, fixed income backgrounds. They just don't have a lot extra. So they are a big part, I think, of resolving this issue that we've talked about today. 55,000 kinship care eligible kids in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. It's a lot of kids. So when that bill was passed, the time came for it to go into effect. And the governor said, no, I don't have the money to make this available. And if we go into like the real nitty gritty of it, really what it is it actually just expands the amount of time in which someone can apply for kinship care benefits. So it actually doesn't change the amount of money that should be available. And this is going into it probably more than you want today. But it's really just a period of time in which someone can apply for kinship care benefits. So there was a dispute. Governor says there's no money for it. The General Assembly says, no, we appropriated funds. And they went back and forth for a while. So we stepped in, and this was from the auditor's side, not from the ombudsman part of my office. And we said, our area of expertise is financial. So we will assist with this. We'd like to look at the books. If there isn't enough money, we'll tell the General Assembly this is how much is needed. If there is money available, then we'll make a recommendation to the Cabinet for Health and Family Services that they can utilize those funds and help these kinship care relatives. This has been my experience with CHFS for quite a while now. They were not cooperative. They were not helpful. So we actually sued them for access to information. It's the first time actually in my knowledge that the auditor's office has ever had to sue somebody to get information. Now, it went through Franklin Circuit. The judge here said that it wasn't ripe, meaning that he felt like we had sued too soon, that the cabinet had told the judge that they would cooperate with us. And the judge took the position that we had acted too quickly on suing them. That has kind of like panned out that I don't think that that was the correct conclusion here, because once that judge dismissed that suit, they still didn't cooperate with us. They still don't give us information.
Even though you requested, let me interrupt. So you followed up after that lawsuit that landed in Franklin Circuit Court, gave them a chance to respond, and they were crickets?
They would not respond. They would say like, we're not required to give you this or whatever their answer was. So they still weren't answering us. And then we took the next step of subpoenaing them. And that's something the judge had said. The judge had said, you haven't subpoenaed them. You haven't gone that route. So we have actually now subpoenaed several people, and we've also subpoenaed information. That is still ongoing. We also made the decision to appeal that first decision as well, the one that the judge dismissed, because we felt like it was ripe. And actually, if you can look the way it's progressed since then, it just backs up the fact that they really are just not cooperative. So unfortunately, this has gone on, I think, way too long. Mm-hmm. Again, this is one of those situations where it's a problem. If we can all just talk to each other and do our jobs, then we can resolve these situations. And I think the focus needs to be on helping these families. These are real families, and these are families that are vulnerable and in need. And I just keep trying to reiterate that to the cabinet, to the governor, to anybody. This is a serious issue. Don't get bogged down on any peripheries. Remember what's at focus here.
Very good. Kentucky State Auditor Allison Ball, thank you so much for your time and joining us here on the Commonwealth Matters. God bless you and keep up the good work.
Very much. It's good to be here.